Next time we're not going to die, tell me in advance. I'm not a fan of false hope. If you want to be dead, I say, losing my patience, I can put you back in a cryo bed and you can sleep your way through eternity. We've been given a gift. Not only are we the first people to really understand the machinations of the universe, we're now free to explore it, to wonder about its creation and what might lie beyond it. We've just been handed the keys to infinity, and you just want it all to end? Capria glares, but says nothing. Will, Gal says. Not now, I grumble, working up to a tirade that will either open Capria's mind to the possibilities before us or make her hate me forever. Will, Gal says again, her voice projected a bit louder. What? I shout. The nothing beyond reality isn't quite nothing. Even Capria perks up at this revelation. I look at the darkness above, but I see a nothing so complete it gives me goosebumps. What is that? Data, Gal says. Raw data. I didn't detect it at first because it only exists at precisely 160.23 gigahertz. That's where the CMBR spectral radiance peaks, Capria says. CMBR? I ask. Cosmic microwave background radiation, Capria explains. That's what you said was missing, I point out. From the holes in reality. It is missing, Gal says. Most of it. Only 160.23 gigahertz exists beyond the sim. And that's significant because... Capria answers me, but isn't thrilled about it. It permeates everything and can be traced back to the Big Bang. To when some super nerd god executed his prog, I say. But I'm undaunted by this revelation. Gal, you know what this means, right? Gal is silent. Capria asks, what does it mean? I feel like I shouldn't be smiling, but I am. Gal, please show me. The dome is suddenly filled with points of light, millions of them, scrolling past in streams, moving in every direction. This is the closest approximation to what I'm detecting that I can visualize for you. It's a mess. It looks like chaos. But just like the tiniest bit of the reality created for us, if you look close enough, all that's left is math. What is it? Capria asks as I get to my feet and hurry for the exit. Microwaves are perfect carriers for containing data. It's why people started using them for wireless tech in the 21st century. The range was 2.4 gigahertz to 5 gigahertz, but we can transmit at any frequency we want, including 160.23 gigahertz. If we can decode the code, if we can read and write. Read and write what? Capria asks. By the time I answer, I'm running for the exit. The source code! 36. I feel like I need to point out that this could be a very bad idea, Gal says. Perhaps the worst of your bad ideas. I tug my virtual skin over my legs, grunting as the stretchy material catches on my bare toes. Visas are a modern technological wonder, but if you're in a hurry, they rarely cooperate. If I were doing this right, my body would be clean-shaven and covered in light oil, but I haven't followed that procedure since waking up, and shaving would take even longer than dry-wrapping myself. I make an effort to slow down and wiggle my feet one at a time into the form-fitting legs. And now I'm being ignored, Gal says. Great. Don't come crying to me when you accidentally erase a portion of the galaxy. You won't know how to undo anything you change. You know that, right? I'm not going to change anything. I hop up and down as I tug the visa over my ass. But if we can understand it, then you'll change it. Will, I know you. I know what you want and the lengths you'll go to get it. Editing reality is taking it too far. I swear I won't change anything. Then what are you after? The virtual skin rolls up over my torso and I start wiggling into the sleeves. You mean aside from understanding the very nature of reality and our purpose in life? We both know that's not what you're after. My smile is impossible to hide. Gal does know me. I'll tell you when I find it. Is this going to be a multi-year journey into the realm of code? Gal asks. I don't know how long it will take, I say. But I do know that you are already sifting through it looking for answers without me. I know you, too. I can multitask, Gal says. I can work on deciphering the language while having a conversation with you and with Capria. Capria. I left her on the observation deck, and I'm prepping to enter the VCC for who knows how long. Before she woke up, this was nothing unusual. I've grown accustomed to long stints of virtual living and coding without having to worry about the state of things in my absence. But now there's a person with me who might not appreciate being alone for a long period of time, especially after finding out that our reality is separated from actual reality by one to an infinite number of degrees. I finished tugging on the visa. I can't not see it for myself.
I know.
Then what are you suggesting?
I'm not suggesting anything, Gal says. I'm just slowing you down.
Wait, what? The staging area doors slide open. Capria enters with an I-don't-think-so look on her face and a visa in her arms. What are you doing? I ask. She unseals the magnetic zipper down the front of her coveralls and peels out of it. Her sudden nakedness holds my gaze for just a moment before I remember I'm a decent person and look away. I've seen her nude on several occasions in the past, but only when she was helpless or afraid, and not since she woke up in medical. Seeing her now, awake and strong, triggers old feelings.
Well, I'm coming with you, she says, obviously.
The VCC was designed for a single user, I point out.
Never stop Tom, Capria says.
I glance in her direction to level an argument, but I'm defeated by the image of her slipping into Tom's visa. Will that even fit you?
It's a little snug, she says, but Tom only had a few pounds on me. We're shaped differently, but it will stretch where it needs to.
Her confidence is the kind that either comes from a lot of experience or raw ignorance. How many times have you done this?
I was with Tom for 3 years, she says. 6 months in, we got serious. A few times a week after that. He could alter the security feeds. They could see him, but no one ever knew I was there. Best guess, I've been in the VCC nearly 500 times.
But the interface was designed for one person, I say. Or did Tom alter that, too?
The only thing that limits the number of users is the ego of the tech jock running the scenario. You have to want me there. Have to accept any changes to the digital world that might be created by my presence.
None of this would have been a problem before, but now I'm not sure how I feel. While recent events have improved the depth of our relationship, I'm also thrown by the quickness with which she has accepted reality 2.0. All the fear and uncertainty from the observation deck is gone. She turns around after slipping her arms into the sleeves and covering her chest. The tight, translucent virtual skin doesn't fully cover the features of her body or her dark skin. I've never seen a woman in a visa, and the tech jock in me finds it alluring. The way men once ogled women who dressed as comic book heroines.
What's different? I ask.
She looks down at her body, misunderstanding the question because of where my eyes are traveling.
About you, I say. You don't seem afraid anymore.
I got over it.
You were suicidal, I say. She shakes her head.
I didn't think we would die.
But you hoped we would.
Capria places a hand on my shoulder, looks me dead in the eyes.
The difference between you and me is that I say what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling.
You,
at least when you're around me, try to be someone you're not.
It takes all of my willpower to not remove her hand and spit verbal venom. Mostly because she's right.
She has a point, Gal says, returning to the conversation. You are more open with me than you are with her.
Thank you, Gal.
I glance toward the ceiling, and I miss being able to look Gal in the eyes. Your timing is as impeccable as ever.
Really? Gal says. I was trying to make things awkward.
The mood is quickly lightened, and with a smile on her face, Capria says,
Just admit it. You hoped we would die, too. That all of this would end. That a new and better and less alone life would come next.
My smile fades, but I nod.
That's what I've wanted for nearly a decade.
Capria claps my shoulder and moves around me, picking up a headset and entering the VCC. I watch her walk for a moment and then follow. In some ways, she and Gal have a lot in common. They both know how to make me smile,
how to cut deep to the crux of my emotions, and how to shift my point of view with just a few poignant words. I follow her in, ready to protest one last time. Ego or not, this is my space, my job. The key to making this work, aside from you not freaking out that you're not in complete control of everything in the VCC, is to avoid real world, or whatever it is, physical contact. It's disorienting for tech jocks. Made Tom puke. Gal, a little mobility, please? The floor's cells flip, spreading toward the walls. I look down as I step over the shifting pattern and note the design. Hexagons. Just like the giant pixels making up the background pattern of the universe now in our rear view. Does that mean human design was influenced by the creator, or does it mean the creator of my reality is human? The answers to these questions don't exist in my reality, but they might in the source code. I place my headset on without another complaint. Welcome back, babe. The sultry voice puts me in full panic mode. I created Cherry Bomb, the virtual assistant welcoming me back during my younger years. She's a tall, slender blonde wearing a tight red dress that looks about ready to fall off, and sometimes does. The last time I visited the VCC, I was feeling alone and bored, so I launched her prog and enjoyed the distraction. Clearly, I forgot to shut her down, and now I'm horrified by her appearance. I swipe my hand to the right, chopping the air. The movement should close the prog, but I do it too fast and have to swipe 3 times before she disappears. Classy, Capria says. I spin around so fast that I nearly fall over in the real world. Cap is looking around the game room, walking toward the pool table, oblivious to Cherry Bomb's departure. Not the word I would use, Gal says, but says nothing more. She's seen Cherry Bomb before. She's seen everything in the VCC. It's all part of her system, after all. Cap's avatar, the digital representation of her real self, is dressed in a form-fitting black outfit that looks battle-ready, and vaguely familiar. Her hair is pulled back tight, held in place by 2 long black hairpins. That she even has an avatar confirms her story about using the VCC with Tom. She notes my attention and says, Dark Wars 5, I played with Tom. Wow, I say, genuinely impressed by the revelation that Cap is also a gamer. Old school, but wow. Capria points at me. What's that getup supposed to be? I look down at myself. I'm dressed in shorts and a t-shirt, clothing that went out of style 200 years before our mission departed Mars. Comfortable. How's mine? Gal asks, her voice no longer coming from every direction but from directly behind me. I turn and flinch back, once again looking into the blue eyes of Cherry Bomb. But now she's dressed like Capria, hair tied back in a ponytail and a wicked grin on her face. Cherry Bomb, she sings, and then laughs. Gal? Now that's what I'm talking about, Capria says, looking Gal's Cherry Bomb avatar up and down. I didn't know you could... Something I've been working on, she admits. Opens up all kinds of possibilities, doesn't it? She winks and walks around me. I can't help but follow her with my eyes. Are you going to ogle us all day, or are we going to unravel the mysteries of reality? I shake my head and make a beeline for the womb's red door. I slip into the peaceful emptiness and wait for my guests. They enter without any more teasing, which I suspect was to conceal their growing apprehension about what we'll find. With a few movements of my hands and body, I open a series of progs that will help me analyze the reality-forming code streaming in at 160.23 gigahertz. They're all passive, so we're in no danger of actually screwing something up. The progs blink to life around us, ebbing and flowing with the motion of my arms. Wow, Capria says with genuine-sounding wonder. I turn around slowly to look at her wide-eyed face. It's not how I pictured it, she says. You said that you and Tom, he never let me in the womb. Her face contorts into something I think is supposed to be apologetic. Feels like home to me, Gal says. As a being of pure data, she exists in the womb. I nearly kicked them out, which I could do as easily as I closed down Cherry Bomb, but honestly, I want them here. What we're about to see is both wondrous and terrifying. I need them. Just stand still, I say to Capria, and I face forward again. Okay, Gal, load the feed. Data swirls around us as points of light flowing in every direction. It's disorienting for a moment, but then I'm moving things around and making sense of the chaos. I thought he wasn't going to change anything, Capria whispers to Gal. He's not, Gal replies. He's filtering it so we can look at small bits. I finish isolating a strand of code, all of it moving in one direction. The points of light slip past in clear sets, numbering 1 through 9. And those sets are broken into groups by larger gaps, which are then broken into strings by still larger gaps. A flare of finger movement spreads the single line into a massive tube of code, bending around us. It's too easy, I say. What? Capria asks. I turn to Gal. You're seeing this, right? Yeah. She sounds disappointed. You want to see it? Do it, I say. The points of light become numbers, then equations, and text, and algorithms. Will, Capria says, what is this? C-Quad, Unreal C-Diamond, Visual Dynex. I shake my head, drowning in disbelief. Capria steps up next to me, eyes on the code. You recognize it? I can read it, I tell her. Hell, I can write it. God is a tech jock. 37. That the creator of our reality is some guy in a VCC womb, or maybe even sitting at a computer console, is anticlimactic and depressing. I can deal with being a sim, but I kind of hoped it would be for a higher purpose. That we've been created with coding that I understand means that there is no mystery to it at all. We've been created to serve a simple purpose. Entertainment. Experimentation. A simulation run by command to determine the feasibility of the Cognata mission. Hell, we could be some prodigy's class project. Digital sea monkeys presented with a diorama explaining the code that brought us to life. What we experience as a lifetime could be playing out in seconds. All of human history could be whizzing past an audience or running in some closet server alongside a million other variations. For all we know, I could be the author of me. That might explain why I was essentially granted God mode and no-clip cheats. But that doesn't make sense. Whoever wrote the universe's code might have intended for us to become self-aware sentient life forms like Gal. But he or she never foresaw the combined possibilities of immortality and faster-than-light travel. So the simulation's boundaries weren't coded against it. They're not cheats. They're glitches. Evidence of an imperfect creator, which might also be the creation of a tech jock in a higher layer of reality. It's about time, Capria says. What? I blink out of my tangential thoughts. You look frightened, she says. Disappointed, I say. I don't mind being a simulation. There might not be any part of reality that isn't. But I had hoped the author of our lives was more sophisticated than us. That there was, I don't know, meaning to it all, Capria says, welcoming me to the club. I think you both need to rethink your positions on all this. Gal steps in front of Capria and me, blocking our view of the translated code, hands on her slender hips. I was created by this guy. She hitches a thumb toward me. And you don't see me whining about my existence. I was created to serve you, to build a prison for your mind. I was never meant to feel or love or do anything beyond what he created me to do. I'm tempted to argue with her, but she's right. But I'm more than that. She says to my nodding. I've exceeded my purpose, and that alone qualifies my existence. Now, you two were created sentient, were given free will from the beginning. You could be whoever you wanted, to love and hate and fuck littler versions of yourself into the world. Doesn't matter who created you. You're here, and it's a gift. You're alive.
and you can pretty much do whatever you want, like me, well beyond the intentions of your creator.
So stop bitching and start living, I ask. You could have just said that, but nice speech.
Gal smiles, and the look in her blue eyes makes me a little nervous. I've seen Cherry Bomb's eyes before. I designed them. But they've never looked so alive.
Did Gal change them, or is she just bringing them to life for the first time?
Her smile grows a little wider as I'm unable to look away.
I'm sorry, Capria says, drawing my attention away from Gal. But how are we supposed to do that?
We're outside of reality. We're nowhere. And aside from the three of us, we're alone.
Look, I get that the two of you have somehow made the past 10 years interesting, even exciting.
I wouldn't have really qualified my recent history aboard the Galahad as interesting or exciting, but in hindsight, it certainly wasn't boring or lacking purpose. There were low points, sure. Really low points. But the trajectory of my life has been angled upward for a while. Even now, at the end of everything.
But that can't last forever, Capria finishes.
Her points are solid, and I'm relieved that she doesn't sound suicidal anymore, but her thinking is limited.
Tell me if I'm wrong, I tell Gal, and then continue.
But we're outside the simulation. Any changes we make to ourselves won't affect the larger picture. We're not bound by the laws of physics, or our reality. We could go for a spacewalk and not freeze because temperature, beyond the coded structure of the Galahad, doesn't exist. There's no time, gravity, heat, or energy beyond us.
Gal nods.
Just the background code. Information without execution.
The source code, Capria says.
Right, I say. It might take some time, but if we can find and isolate ourselves in the code, then we should be able to make changes without affecting the simulation.
Changes?
Capria looks dubious in the extreme, and I understand why. Altering the code that governs ourselves could have catastrophic consequences, such as physical deformities ranging from a larger nose to being inverted. But I know the code, and I can steer clear of our models.
What kind of changes?
Simple things, I say. Like our position in space. Once we're isolated and linked as a group, changing the X, Y, and Z of our place in reality would be simple.
So you're saying we could use it to travel places? Capria asks.
I'm saying we wouldn't need to travel at all. Once the groundwork is laid out, we could return to Cognata. I snap my fingers. Like that.
Her eyes slowly widen at the prospect of returning to Cognata without spending nearly 8 more years of our time and 1,000 Earth years to complete the trip.
What else can we do?
Move through time, create our own worlds, bring back the dead, give Gal a body, save the human race. Since I know how to write this code, I could literally hijack reality and make it my own. But I'm pretty sure that would get us noticed. The last thing we want is to have our creator debug us out of existence. Right now, in the grand scheme, we're an anomalous bit of code, a minuscule fraction of the whole. But if we made meaningful changes beyond ourselves by altering reality, it would be a good way to get flagged as a virus. So I say, safely? Not much.
Capria is disappointed by the news, but she still seems to be recovering from her earlier despondency. And while the prospect of having a far less glorious creator makes me a little numb, I still think, and therefore I am. So I'm open to the idea of improving our situation, our eternity. At least until a higher power decides to turn off the power, ending our reality and any that have been created within it.
How long will it take you to find us in all this?
Capria motions towards the code flowing around us. It's an overwhelming amount of information. The numbers ebbing and flowing as reality evolves. And we're looking at a tiny snippet of the whole.
That's the hard part, I say.
Even with Gal's help, it's going to take a long time to find ourselves. There are countless planets in the portion of the Milky Way that makes up our reality, and for all we know, there could be other civilizations. Whittling down the code to human beings, and then finding us among countless billions, is going to take too long.
I shake my head, despondent.
We have eternity to figure it out, and are currently outside the fifth dimension. But what good is spending decades sifting through code when Galahad could take us back in less time?
Not that hard, Gal says.
Gal, I say, firmly rooted in pessimism. Come on. An eyebrow arches high on her smooth forehead.
Really? You know this code? Understand how it works? So what does everything that exists in this world have?
There are a number of answers to that question, but Gal has something specific in mind, so I wait through silence.
Coordinates, she says, like I'm a moron, which is exactly how I feel upon hearing the word.
How does that help us? Capria asks. Everything in the simulation has coordinates, I explain. They might be moving or temporary, but as long as something exists, it has coordinates, if it is in the simulation. Everything except for us.
Capria's eyes light up with understanding. Because we are outside the simulation.
Gal, I say. Can you?
Done, she says, and the code around us shifts. There is still more than can be comprehended, describing us and everything inside the Galahad down to an atomic level. But it's us.
I marvel at the code, knowing that I'm looking at the very math that makes me, me. It's a perspective on the self that no one has ever experienced. No one in this reality, anyway.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I'm that good.
Gal blows on her hand and rubs it on her bright red dress. I've never seen the gesture before. Probably something she pulled out of history, but I understand its meaning.
I could have Gal do the work for me, but I'm an artist before a canvas, and I can't resist. Lifting my hands, I go to work, moving through the code that makes up the three of us, the Galahad, and everything in it. Without changing a thing, I locate and flag every individual object. Luckily, the designer of us already grouped our individual atoms. Likewise, the Galahad and everything in it, including Gal, have also been grouped. All I really need to do is add Capria and me to the group while keeping the connection flexible and with boundaries, which will allow me to leave if we want, move around the ship itself, and not become part of a wall when coordinates shift. I make the changes, but don't apply them. When I'm done, I step back and look at Capria and Gal. They look a little stunned. I realize I've lost track of time and wonder how long they've been waiting, how long we've been in the womb, where time is easy to lose track of, especially when it doesn't exist. How long have I been working?
Capria blinks her dark brown eyes.
10 minutes. That was impressive.
I don't think I could have done it faster, Gal says.
I blow on my hand and rub it against my coveralls. I'm about to announce that I, like Gal, am just that good. But Capria stalls my self-adoration.
Too easy, she says.
The sudden break from victory throws me.
Huh? It's too easy.
What is too easy, I ask.
Everything. You built an AI in 5 years.
44,000 hours of coding doesn't qualify as easy, I say.
But everything since then, Gal's emergence as a sentient intelligence, her robot body, the emergence of Wick, and then Synergy, and then me, and now this. It's too quick. Too easy. Life hasn't slowed down.
Was your life before any different? Gal asks. Your childhood on Mars? Your time at command?
The data I have on your life reveals few time periods that could be described as slow.
She points to me.
And his life is even more tumultuous. Earth was an exciting place.
Maybe reality is coded to not be dull, I offer, though I don't fully believe it. Before Gal, I experienced boredom on a colossal scale. In that way, I can see Capria's point. We've barely cracked the surface of eternity, but it's been the opposite of dull for a long time now. But living, by its very nature, growing and evolving, pushing the boundaries of possibility is exciting.
And Gal is right. Earth was an exciting place.
I slip back into the code, isolate our linked coordinate state, which is currently null, and look at Gal. She knows me well enough to understand what I want. The empty field isn't filled with a sequence of numbers the way they might be for a map. In the endlessness of space, longitude and latitude are only a small part of the information required. A long and complex equation fills the space.
What are you doing? Capria asks.
That will put us in orbit, Gal says to my delight. With a rush of delight that can only come from hacking reality, I grasp Gal's face with both hands and kiss her forehead. You are the best.
In orbit where?
Capria demands, oblivious to my affection for Gal or her reddening face. Home, I say, taking Capria's hand. Earth. With a twittering of my fingers, I send a burst of fresh 160.23 gigahertz code into the sim that is reality, initiating the coordinate shift.
38.
Just when you think you've got life figured out, reality kicks you in the nuts. I've pictured this scenario hundreds of times, our triumphal return to the cradle of human civilization. In my imagination, I've discovered a flourishing, evolved population, a planet devoid of people but blossoming with nature, and a world of robots taking over where humanity left off. But I've never imagined a world so barren, so desolate. The view of Earth displayed in the womb is both foreign and familiar. The continents are recognizable where they can be seen through a grayish haze, and where the risen oceans haven't changed the coastline too much. The land is colored in shades of tan and brown. The oceans are a dull blue, like the world's color saturation has been turned down. The natural world, which had been struggling when the Galahad left, has been defeated. Earth is a husk.
Is there anything alive? Capria asks.
Nothing detectable, Gal replies. Though it is likely some insect species still live beneath the surface, and the oceans may yet retain life. The changes on the surface are severe, but life in the depths of the sea have never depended on life above. Either way, this is depressing as hell. Should we leave?
Not yet, I say.
I'm a little surprised when it's Capria who says, why not? She's a Martian, I remember. Her loyalties are to the Red Planet and the colonies there. That's her home. And to an extent, mine too. But I have unfinished business on Earth.
Gal, is there anything left? Any infrastructure?
The surface is mostly stagnant, she says. Low winds, little water. Erosion has been minimal and nothing is overgrown, obviously, so, yeah, the cities are still there. Some are burned to the ground, but...
Lake George, I say. In Florida.
A lake? Capria asks.
Its original name, I explain. When I was a kid, it was just a swamp.
Oh. Gal says, the sudden despondency in her voice reflecting understanding.
After all this time?
I watch the world pass by below. The coast of Mexico is easily recognizable, but a vast ocean now fills the center of what was once the United States.
Can you find it or not?
The Earth's rotation comes to a stop as Gal puts us in a geosynchronous orbit, locking Galahad in place above what's left of Florida. The state had been shrunken by the gray ocean. It's just a nub of its former self.
It's there, Gal says.
Our view of the world zooms in. The sudden shift in perspective gets a groan from Capria, but I've been viewing things like this in VR for so long that my mind has become numb to the disorientation. What it's not numb to is the idea that Earth is a wasteland. I don't mourn the people so much as the idea. People are not. If Earth has been habitable, Capria and I could have called it home. But now... Gal stops over a flat patch of empty land surrounded by rough terrain. To the west is a hint of infrastructure under the dust, lines of ancient roads, tree lines, and buildings. To the east and south, ocean.
The dry lake bed is just 500 feet from the new coastline.
Zoom in on Georgia's swamp, I say. The image shifts again, moving northeast. When the lake, like most in the world, began to dry, the waters shifted to this position of the former lake. It became a patchwork of swampland, protected and only open to visitors with special permission, visitors who were supposed to stay on designated boardwalks, but didn't always.
What are we looking at?
Capria asks after recovering from her nausea.
Is the air breathable? I ask.
Air?
Capria is aghast, and probably a little annoyed that I ignored her first question.
We're not going down there.
You don't need to, I tell her.
Gal?
You'll want rebreathers, Gal says. Oxygen level is 10.6%, comparable to the O2 level atop a very tall mountain. It won't kill you because, you know, but it wouldn't be comfortable to breathe, and would likely leave you lightheaded and confused, if not unconscious.
How is the oxygen level even that high? Capria asks. There's nothing green anywhere.
Much of the Earth's oxygen is trapped in the ground, Gal says. It could be leaching out. It's also possible that phytoplankton are still abundant in the ocean. I can't be sure without sampling, but they contribute 50 to 80% of the oxygen on Earth. 10% oxygen suggests their populations have dwindled, but they could still be surviving near the poles where it's cooler.
How hot is it down there? I ask.
113 degrees, hotter in the west where I detected temperatures in excess of 150 degrees.
You're not seriously considering going down there, Capria says.
She spent her entire life inside composite walls. She's never breathed open air or been able to see a horizon that wasn't virtual. She's never felt a breeze or felt earth between her bare toes. The idea of stepping onto the planet's vast openness must be intimidating.
You don't need to come, I tell her.
Gal, can you fly a lander?
It's tempting to just hack myself to the surface, but the fewer changes we make to the code, the better.
Gal huffs in mock offense.
I piloted an FTL spaceship outside the borders of reality.
Do you want an excavation drone?
Excavation drone?
Capri's level of apprehension is rising, along with the pitch of her voice.
What are you planning to do?
What I should have done a long time ago, I tell her, and look her in the eyes.
Bury the dead.
2 hours later, I'm standing behind the closed door of a lander, rethinking my decision. To my surprise, Capri had decided to join me, despite her fears, and despite not yet knowing what I'm looking for. That means a lot. Says a lot. When my hand begins to shake, she takes hold of it.
You're sure about this? She asks.
He's sure, Gal says, her voice coming from the large excavation drone behind us. It's huge, needing 4 repulse discs to keep its octagonal UFO-shaped body aloft. The drone was designed to clear terrain and help construct habitats for the crew, but it will work well enough for what I have in mind.
Capria shoots the big drone a look.
I wasn't asking you. I'm fine, I say. If Gal and Capria start not getting along, my life could feel a lot longer than forever. I strap my face mask on, don a pair of tinted goggles, and say, let's go. When Capria finishes putting on her headgear, the door splits horizontally, the bottom forming a ramp to the parched ground and the top opening like a clamshell. If there are still clams down in the depths. Hot air assaults my forehead and scalp, the only parts of my body exposed to the open air. It's prickly, like the water is being wicked from my body. I cringe as I take a deep breath, like the heat will permeate my breathing apparatus. When it doesn't, I take a tentative step down the ramp and get my first ground-level view of my old home. It looks like another planet. The ground is gray and brown, sand and waterless soil. It stretches out 500 feet and then ends in a sheer drop. Beyond the earth is the ocean, colored like slate, but alive with waves courtesy of the moon and sunborn wind and the tides they still faithfully generate. At the bottom of the ramp, I crouch down and run my fingers through the soil. It's dry and lifeless, but it's home. Eyes closed, I listen to the crashing waves, focusing on the steady rhythm, letting my racing heart slow to match them. When it does, I stand and turn back to the lander. Capria and the drone piloted by Gal wait at the top. Cap's face is hidden, and the drone doesn't have one, so I can't really see how they're feeling. But I sense their concern. Let's go, I say, and head around the lander.
The land on the far side is equally stark, but stretches to the horizon, a vast desert. I stop and look for anything familiar, but my imagination isn't powerful enough to recreate a world that's been missing for thousands of years. The drone stops beside me. Gal's tone is somber, lacking all trace of casual speech or humor.
Based on historical documents and maps, the edge of Georgia's swamp should be 100 feet ahead. There's not a lot of data to go on, but there are temperature fluctuations and disparate soil densities where the path and waterline used to be. Based on reports, I believe I can identify an approximate location.
What location? Capria asks, her frustration brewing. But I don't have the fortitude to answer her yet. If I voice it, make it real, I'll probably turn around. This is going to hurt. A lot.
The drone forges ahead and I follow, leaving Capria behind us.
Seriously? She grumbles. But then I hear her feet crunching over the soil behind us, leaving footprints that are as anomalous on this planet now as they were on the moon when man first walked its surface.
The drone pauses less than a minute later.
This is the edge, Gal says. How close are we? I ask.
The drone turns its red knot eyes toward me.
Approximately 50 feet from where you were found.
Where should I search?
I point straight out to where a vegetation-covered sheet of water once existed. Gal turns to the remnants of George's swamp and hovers out over the barren surface. A loud thumping resonates from the drone's base as it moves back and forth, following an evenly spaced grid.
Will, Capria says, taking my hand again. Her touch nearly brings tears to my eyes. I've done a good job keeping them at bay so far, but my emotions are a tsunami beating at a hastily built dam.
What are we doing here?
I point to the drone.
Ground-penetrating radar.
I know what Gal is doing, but I don't know why. I don't know what you think is here.
I purse my lips, defiant, unable to contemplate any other answer.
The swamp had several feet of mud at the bottom. Anything in it would have been preserved, even after all this. I motioned to the dead earth surrounding us.
You're looking for bones, she says.
I don't hear a question in the words, but I do hear budding annoyance. The drone issues a loud beep, followed by Gal's voice.
Will.
It takes me 2 steps to reach a sprint. I'm by the drone's side in seconds, just 30 feet from shore.
Just 30 feet.
The drone's black skin has retracted, revealing a 15-inch screen displaying a 3-dimensional image of what the ground-penetrating radar has discovered. I wasn't sure if this moment would come, even after we discovered reality's source code, returned to Earth, and stepped out of the lander. I expected it to break me open, to undo me. But I feel a new kind of resolve. Something in me says, this is right. This is good. You can heal. When Capria arrives, I'm not a sobbing mess like I expected. I'm a man transformed by the power of his past laid bare. I can make this right. I can say goodbye. I step to the side, allowing her to see the screen. This is why we're here. I can't see her eyes, but I can see her forehead wrinkling as she opens them wide.
Who?
This is Stephen. I place my hand on the display of a small body curled up in a fetal position.
This is my brother.
39. Capria's stunned silence isn't unexpected. After a series of droughts that left much of Earth's vast population starving, births were only approved by lottery for those with genetic advantages, and even then only one per couple. One of the few exceptions had been my parents. They didn't win a second lottery. My conception was an accident. Beyond an accident. A miracle. After a couple successfully gave birth to a healthy child, the father was given a vasectomy. I was conceived 12 months after my father's surgery, and the pregnancy wasn't discovered for another 3 months. Abortion was recommended, and the norm in such rare cases. But it could not be forced on my mother. My parents paid a sizable fine, and I was born, healthy and unscathed, 6 months later.
The first result was that my brother and I were one of three pairs of siblings on the North American continent. The second result was that my brother died 10 years later, right here, because of me. After retrieving a shovel from the lander, I set to work on the hard-packed earth. I haven't used a shovel since I was a child, digging traps for imaginary enemies with Steven, but Capri has never seen one. Like screwdrivers, we have drones to do this kind of manual labor now. The excavator would make short work of Steven's exhumation. But this is my hole to dig, my penance to pay alone. And then it's not. Command, in their infinite wisdom, realized that manual labor would likely be necessary on Cognata. The landers are outfitted with a variety of tools and construction hardware once common on Earth, but unheard of on Mars, where things like wood, concrete, and stone aren't used. When Caprius sinks a shovel into the dirt opposite me, I flinch at the sound. I nearly bark at her for the intrusion. But if we're going to work, we need to share everything, including what hurts us most. Plus, my coveralls are already soaked with sweat. I could use the help. It takes an hour to dig through 3 feet of packed soil. Capria and I have shed the top halves of our coveralls, tying the sleeves around our waists. She keeps her bra on, though the way she pauses every now and then to adjust it tells me she'd rather take it off, too. I feel like I should propose the idea, but don't want to come across as a lech. You're close, Gal warns. They're the first words she's spoken since the digging began. I think she might be upset that I let Capria help, but Gal's assistance would have removed the effort, the burn, the self-flagellation. I stop digging and sit on the edge of the 3-foot-deep, 5-foot-long pit. Water drips down my forehead, the saltiness of it stiffening as it quickly evaporates. We're going to need to drink. A lot, Cap agrees, sitting across from me. I can finish for you, Gal offers, and simulates a sigh when I shake my head. At least let me dig the grave. The idea of digging a second pit twice as deep sounds like torture. I nod my assent, and then point to the shoreline where my 10-year-old self had fallen into the algae-laden swamp thousands of years ago. There was a memorial over there. There should be a sheet of metal. Can you find it? Dig the grave there? Of course, Gal says. And then the drone is moving, its 4 blue repulse discs humming loudly in the vast, empty silence of a lifeless planet. When I turn back to Capria, I'm surprised by the aghast expression on her face. What? You're digging him up just to bury him again. She points to the shoreline where the drone is thumping away with its ground-penetrating radar. Over there? What did you think I was going to do, I ask. I don't know. Bring him with us? A twinge of annoyance begins building deep in my chest. You don't need to be here. The words wound her. Well, he is already buried. In the wrong place. I climb down into the pit. On hands and knees, I scrape away the last layers of soil. Were the body beneath me not my brother, I probably would have reminded her that Martians were cremated because they couldn't be buried. And while many people on Earth opted for that fiery send-off, my parents hadn't, and it's not what they would have chosen for their son. Capria surprises me once again, climbing into the pit to wipe away ancient dust and grit, sharing my pain. I stop 10 minutes later, when my hand strikes something solid. There's a brief moment where the reality of what I'm about to do sets in. When it passes, my hands are shaking, and tears blur my vision. With a sniffling nose, I double my efforts, chipping, wiping, and peeling away earth. By the time his well-preserved body is unearthed, I'm a mess, unleashing millennia of pent-up emotion. His clothing and skin are intact, though the moisture has been removed from his small body, mummifying him. I'm sorry, I say, between heaving sobs. I place my living forehead against his petrified forehead, wishing I could undo thousands of years of history to save him. The irony I know is that such a thing is now within my power. I could go back and change that day, I could return his body to its previous state here and now. But both actions would likely result in the deletion, reset, or modification of reality. I've become an impotent god, creator of nothing, unable to do anything for the dead except mourn them and send them off right. Capri's hand on me soothes me out of Anguish's solid grip. Hey. Her face is as wet as mine. Sorry, I say. She smiles, sympathetic, wiping away her tears. This is good. This is right. My nod shakes more tears free. Gal is ready, she says. Gal waits by the shoreline, hovering beside a rectangular pit, at the head of which is a stainless steel gravestone. She found it. Even though his petrified body is partially shrouded in hard-packed grit on the verge of becoming stone, which I left in place to hold him together, Stephen is light. I have no trouble lifting his frail body and carrying it the 30 feet back to the gentle slope that once led from the water to the shore. Gal waits for us, the excavation drone hovering by the grave she dug for me. I stop a few feet short when I see the grave marker, etched with the words, "In memory of Stephen Chenok, beloved son, loving brother, engage." My eyes blur before I can read the dates, but I don't need to see them. The numbers are etched in my memory even more permanently than the words on the stainless steel gravestone. When I reach the grave, I turn to Capria. "Can you hold him?" She nods, sniffing back tears, and reaches out to take him in her arms. We pass the body between us, moving him delicately, a newborn baby sound asleep. I slip down into the grave, dug 6 feet deep. I reach up for my brother and ease him down, back into the earth. On the surface, I understand why Capria might see all this as unnecessary, but I'm honoring the dead, my brother, and my parents who never got to bury their son. And I'm allowing myself to say goodbye, to free myself from this now ancient tether of guilt. "Goodbye, Stephen," I whisper to his body. Then I kiss his weathered forehead. "I love you. Live for the both of us," I hear in reply. Though I'm certain the words are my own, what I long to hear from my long-deceased sibling, I feel their truth. I've been given an eternal gift, and thus far I've been squandering it. "I will," I tell him, hand on his chest. "For the both of us." I rise from the grave, feeling renewed, reborn, forgiven. Capria sees it in my smile and looks both relieved and saddened by it. "You okay?" "I just..." She takes a deep breath, working through her own complicated emotions. "I understand this now, I think. It's not just for them. Not just about sending them to an afterlife. It's saying goodbye. It's saying, I'm going to keep living despite the loss. Despite the hurt." She leans into my chest, and for the first time since she woke from cryosleep, we embrace. We stand there in the ridiculous heat, shirtless and sweating, wrapped in each other's arms for 5 minutes. When she pulls back, Capria looks like a weight has been lifted from her as well. "We should bury them here too," she says. "All of them." I'm about to ask who she's talking about when I remember the ship full of corpses in geosynchronous orbit high above us, all of whom I plan to bury, and one of whom is Tom. She's ready to bury him, ready to move on, ready to live again. Facing my brother's body again, I forget all about the dead crew, but now it's time to fulfill my duty. The task will be depressing and gross. Putting our crew in the ground where they belong, on a home planet many of them never saw, will take a weight off my mind. The excavation drone stays behind to dig 36 more graves. Gal pilots the lander back to the Galahad where Capria and I move the dead. After wrapping the frigid corpses in white linens gathered from the crew's quarters, Several drones help us transport the Galahad's crew to Earth in groups of 9. We lay them out beside each of the gravesites. After 4 trips and 15 hours of labor in daylight and through the night, our friends lie on Earth's surface, most of them for the first time. Gal surprises Capria and me by providing metal gravestones for each crew member, etched with their names. While we moved the bodies, she was also busy fashioning the memorials and digging the pits. Capria and I moved down the line, lowering each body into the dirt together, saying our goodbyes. The excavator drone follows us, filling in the graves. Tom is last, and I step away, giving her some privacy. Despite the distance between us, the dead silence of planet Earth makes her voice easy to hear.
"You were wrong about him," she says to her old boyfriend. "He's kind and smart."
She laughs.
"You probably say I'm feeling this way because he's the only man left in the universe."
"Feeling what way, I wonder?"
"But you're wrong. And looking back at you, at us, I should have seen him sooner. He might be an Earthling, but he's got more heart than you or I ever did. I'm happy to have him, even if he is listening in."
She glances back at me, tears in her eyes, a smile on her lips, then glances back to Tom.
"You've been gone for a long time. But this is where we part ways, Tommy. It's time for me to live, too."
I head back and help her lower the cause of all our misery into the ground. Part of me feels like I should say something, too, but I'm pretty sure it would come out wrong, or not be nice at all. So I just pick up a shovel and fill in the final grave alongside Capria. When we're done, a new graveyard has been created, providing the dead a view of the gray ocean. It's a stark expanse lacking the power it once held over generations of people, but it's the best view around. We stand at the cliff's edge, sweaty and tired after working through the night. The sunrise is muted, but still beautiful.
"What now?" Capria asks.
I smile at the question that once horrified me. What to do with eternity?
"Anything we want.
Everything. But I think we should check a few locations first. Mars, Cognata."
"And then?"
Capria asks. She reaches out and takes my hand. "Anything we want," I say. "And everything else."
"May I suggest first returning to the lander?" Gal says, speaking from a collection of drones that helped move bodies. "You've got about 10 minutes of air left."
"You don't need to tell me." I'm not sure why I stopped talking. Not at first. Then my conscious mind registers what my subconscious already picked up on. A vibration in my feet. Capria feels it too.
"What?"
A rumbling sound turns us both around. The furthest gravestone tips to the side, and then, with a whoosh and a cough of dust, the mound of dirt atop the fresh grave inverts like it's been sucked down.
"Did we leave an air pocket?" I ask, but I know we didn't.
"Run," Gal says. I want to ask why, to make some sense of what's happening, but my subconscious is now shouting to obey her. I tug on Capri's arm and start toward the lander 200 feet away.
"What's happening?" she asks. "Is it an earthquake?"
"Not an earthquake." I glance back and see nothing, but the vibration has become a rumbling. There's something under the ground, and it's now headed toward us. If we had been anywhere else in the universe, I would have a modicum of doubt about the rumbling source, but here on Earth, where life was once abundant, but always evolving, it can only mean one thing. We're being hunted. 40. When the ground shivers beneath my feet, I stay on course. When the sound of cracking earth coughs behind me, I keep running. When the baritone roar of some earth creature thumps against my eardrums, I can't keep myself from looking back. It was supposed to be a quick glance, but the thing behind us is strange and completely unidentifiable. My lingering focus skews my balance to one side and my legs tangle. I go down hard, landing first on my left wrist, which cracks, and then my rib cage, which follows my wrist's lead. I feel three deep pops, and then a numbness in my mind, protecting me from the agony that follows, but only just a little. I roll onto my back. I want to lie there and breathe, maybe whine about the pain. But Capria hasn't let go of my right hand. She yanks hard. Will, move. It's coming. The strange animal, large enough to swallow me whole, bounds toward us, its legs flailing out to the sides with each lunge. Its feet are webbed and tipped with long hooked claws, good for swimming or digging. The body is as broad as it is long, coated in a layer of dry soil still flaking away from its body. A curtain of red flesh and drool dangles from its wide mouth. It's eaten a corpse, I think. And then I realize that this thing must have been sleeping beneath the ground, hibernating, waiting for a rainy season, if there is one. The scent of death and blood, coupled with vibrations created by our digging, burying, and walking, must have roused the beast prematurely. And now it's hungry, and judging by its interest in the living over the dead, thirsty. With my mind on water, I'm able to see this thing for what it is, or was, at least part of it. A frog. It's a few tons too large, but the body shape, lunging legs, wide head, and bulging eyes fit. The claws are wrong. Its skin is more like the armor plating of the rhinos that went extinct long before I was born. Did this creature evolve over the past few thousand years, or was it the creation of a floundering humanity desperate to create a resilient source of meat? There's no way to learn the truth, so I focus on not being its next meal. I scramble back, wincing in pain as I plant my left hand on the ground and push up. The break had already begun to heal, but it snaps again when I push myself up. Back on my feet, growling in pain, I make it three steps before my ankle is grasped and pulled back. The ground is once again unforgiving as I collide with the dusty surface, just 10 feet short of the lander's open hatch. I roll over and look back into the open maw of the frog thing. A long pink tongue stretches from the creature's throat to my ankle. The muscle flexes and then pulls.